is an interview with Governor Attia. This is tape 19, side 2.
Constantly saying that the legislature should provide more dollars for schools. Mm-hmm. And we were over all those years. Each buying them, there would be more money going in. But the percent, because they kept talking about percent, was going down. And the reason it was going down is that school budgets were going up faster than any money we could put in. Hmm. So when we start talking about, we may put, I don't recall the numbers now, but if we put $200 million in, one biennium, that might have constituted 30%. We might put in $275 million next biennium, but the percent might go down to 27. So we're putting more money in, but the percent goes down because they were going up faster than we could put money in. Mm-hmm. And I kept fretting about it, so I'm trying to limit. You recall we talked about Senate Bill, it was either one or two, where we're going to describe the what is basic education, and then we'll fund that. It's all part of the same thing. My thought was, okay, we'll describe basic education, then the state will say, we will pay for that. There was some way of controlling, you know, what the cost was going to be in terms of state government. So this was another approach at the same way, trying to control some way so we could get our percentage up, because they were going up faster than we could deal with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And apparently the other members of the committee didn't feel that way.
Well, OEA doesn't. Now, I want to say again, because I'm sure I said once before, but the most powerful lobby was not business. And I think I remember I told you that.
Yes.
Everybody liked to point to it. And I've told business people it's the biggest fairy tale I've ever heard in my life. The most powerful lobby then, and probably still now, is Oregon Education Association.
I was wondering, I noticed a session that you had a number of bills, and in terms of your own work, since you don't you weren't chair of any committee, you have one secretary. How did you keep track of all the bills? What was your tracking method?
I mean, my bills or the bills introduced?
Your bills.
Oh well, I knew what my bills were.
Mm-hmm. But you had quite a few of them. I think that this session, you had more than a dozen.
Well, that's not too many.
Really?
Actually, in relation to other legislators, that's quite a that's very stingy.
Is that right?
Yeah, and it wasn't hard keeping track of it.
Did you have the various groups that you were working with basically keep track of them and then inform you as to where they were in terms of committees and
well, there
meetings
was that, but always, you know, if it came for a hearing,
uh-huh.
They'd always call the chief sponsor, which in this case would have been me.
Right.
And it depended who introduced it, for myself or for, you remember earlier talked about Secretary of State. When the bill would come up, I'd have Secretary of State kind of carry that one,
mm-hmm.
because I've introduced it for them, not necessarily for myself. So that wasn't particularly difficult. If there's something I was intensely interested in, I would keep quite close track of what the stage is and where it is and what's mm-hmm. happening to it. Mm-hmm. Then you have to follow it. If it's my Senate bill, I have to follow it to the House. But it wasn't really all that difficult. Some legislators would put in, oh gosh, 50, 60, 70 bills, a whole lot of them. So I was never one to put in a whole lot of bills.
But your involvement with your own bills, was that a lot greater than the bills that you introduced on behalf of various groups and
yeah.
organizations?
Yeah, because I would ask someone else to carry the ball on that.
Right.
Right.
So your own bills that you introduced for your own legislation you were able to follow that pretty
yeah.
carefully.
Yeah, and basically because it's pretty limited.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of reciprocal arrangement with other legislators that, you know, say in that committee, that they'll keep you informed about what goes on in the committee and offer
suggestions?
Well,
it would be one vehicle. If there was something I was interested in, let me know. Somebody that I know that's on that committee, if it's not mm-hmm. one of my own committees.
Right.
But that's not a difficult task. It really is not difficult.
You try to get legislators to in a particular committee where you don't, where you're not sitting, and your bill is in that committee. Do you get them to basically see that bill through that committee? Or?
No, that's still my responsibility, not theirs. They've got their own bills. And you have to understand that the Senate still is only a 30-member body.
Right.
And my bills aren't in that many committees, that many different committees. And obviously, I know all the chairmen. So it's not a difficult task. Mm-hmm. Not difficult at all.
You were on a number of other committees that session, credentials. The Task Force on Energy, what was that dealing with? Obviously energy, but what kind of energy legislation or issues?
You know, it really is strange, the things I've forgotten about my legislative days. I don't recall. I developed something of my own when I became governor, but I don't recall that.
You were on the Legislative Committee on Land Use, and you had a joint resolution, number 44, requesting approval of 19 statewide planning goals adopted by the LCDC, which was left in committee. I know that the LCDC was very controversial, but why would the adoption of their statewide planning goals be left in committee?
There was an air of uncertainty when the goals were established. And they were adopted by the Land Conservation and Development Commission. Powerful effect. Cities and counties had to conform with those statewide goals and guidelines. And so I'm in effect saying what I wanted to accomplish, which I didn't do, was let's give them some assurance that the sands aren't going to be shifting. This is not a statute. This is a regulation by an agency of state government. They can change the regulation. You might come up, while you're going through the process of your zoning, well, they say, well, now, wait a minute, that's not exactly what we meant. What we meant was such and such, which incidentally they were doing. So in effect, they were constantly changing goalposts. And so what I was trying to do is to put this into law. What I was trying to do is say, these are the goals and guidelines. Now, those that were fervored land use planners, they want that.
But then why did you have a joint resolution? Why didn't you sponsor legislation to actually adopt those goals?
Joint resolution, at least my best hope. I knew where what the odds were. So the thing to do was to define it somewhere by the legislature saying, well, this is what we think that they should be, which is what. Actually, I was going to take the ones that were adopted. I'm going to change anything, say, okay, there they are. We'll put them over here.
Is your strategy in terms of joint resolutions, like, say, that, like for instance, this one, to get the legislature to adopt a certain direction without the specific legislation and then come back at a later date and actually address that issue in terms of legislation, saying, well, this is in concurrence with
the necessarily.
Resolution?
In other words, you look and see, okay, what are the odds of my getting any changes at all? And, okay, if I step back from glue it in the statutes, maybe I got a better chance doing this than I would by trying to get in the statute. I didn't have a chance to do either one, but the whole idea was, and it's true, there was a great deal of controversy, and when I became governor, one of the main things I wanted to do was to get this whole process finished. And so there were some complaints, and they were legitimate. But this is what you said. Well, yeah, that's what we said then, but we've changed our mind. And so how could cities and counties, you know, really finally come up with a plan that could be adopted by the LCDC? Because they were always, you know, changing the rules, changing the goalposts. And it was terrible while we were going through the process. And I was trying to pull some of the antagonism and the crisis nature out of it. But there were those that wanted to keep it that way. They didn't want the certainty that I was looking for and that cities and counties were looking for.
Well, I guess we can talk more a little more about the LCDC later, because you became more involved in that than as governor, didn't you?
Yeah.
So, I guess one thing that I wonder about this, though, you had some differences of opinion with the LCDC over certain goals that they were adopting, didn't you? Weren't you a little more interested in tempering some of the more far-reaching goals?
Yeah.
Did the goals that they embraced at this point coincide with what your feelings about the LCDC and where it should be where?
Yes, but you see, let's break it down for a minute. Mm-hmm. And part of the battle that I had, even as I became governor, LCDC stands for Land Conservation and Development Commission. Mm-hmm. But they kept dropping the D like it never existed. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, D means something. This doesn't mean that you're going to put everything that's there now and lock it in cement. Mm-hmm. And but they kept forgetting the D part. And it was always conservation. And I understood going back to history, the things that I kind of liked, why people came here. Mm-hmm. They came here. They came here. Starting, well, now we've got the centennial of it, the big migration, 1843, and they were looking for land of their own. They were looking for, you know, something that's mine, that I can do something with. And all of a sudden, the state comes along and says, oh, you can't do that anymore. Oh, wait a minute, this is my land, my money. I put something into it. No, I'm sorry, you can't do that anymore. So I understood, you know, we still had the Western attitude that this is my land. I knew, as I told you earlier, that we're going to have to do this. I knew that it was important for my children and other people's children and their children to know that Oregon is going to grow in a very orderly way. I knew that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I didn't believe in rubbing people's noses in it. Mm-hmm. And I, oh my, the discussions I had with the department and the commission. I can recall going to some kind of meeting. It was happened to be up at Timothy Lake, meeting with planners. Now, the other thing, it was amazing. We jumped on the land use bandwagon, passed Senate Bill 100, adopted 19 goals. Cities and counties all had to come up with a plan to match the 19 goals. And there weren't that many land planners in the United States, let alone the state of Oregon. But all of a sudden, there were planners. And some really weren't educated as planners. They didn't know, but now it's a bureaucratic job. I got a job. I'm a planner. So now they're doing it according to their own views of what ought to happen, most of which left the D out and kept the C in. And I can recall going to that meeting up at Timothy Lake, and I said, you know, you've got these felt pens. And they're yellow, and they're blue, and they're pink, and they're red. But you have to realize that when you put that pen down, there's people down there. Mm-hmm. But they really didn't want to be bothered with people. People were kind of vexation. No, this is where the line ought to be, you know, and they put these lines there. I said, there's people under there, real human beings. So I was trying to convert some sensitivity into this process. Never, ever thought we should divert from an orderly land planting of our land. Mm-hmm. But still I had that great feeling of understanding that why people are upset, why they're mad. I think we've already touched on some of these things, but that a farmer has his home, son wants to take over the business. He can't build his own, he can't build a house on that. Now yeah. That's crazy. You see, that this is what I call dumb. Mm-hmm. Those are things. But there are people who just didn't want anything to happen. No changes, nothing. Mm-hmm. Bang, state of Oregon is now locked in forever. Well, it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. At least I don't think it works, nor should it work that way.
Did you feel that these goals that you were requesting approval of helped put the D back in the LCDC?
Yeah, because one of the goals happened to relate to development, at least one. Happened to relate to it. But that wasn't the reason to put the D back in. The really reason was quit changing the goalpost. That was the real reason. And incidentally, again, for the tape, there was 14 statewide goals that applied to every county and city in Oregon, plus 5 that related only to coastal counties and cities. Mm-hmm. So there were 5 coastal zones, and the coast had also the other 14. The rest of the state had 14.
You were also on legislative trade and economic development. Did this go back to the international trade?
Well, it was moving slowly in that direction. We didn't do, it wasn't a pell-mell rush.
You were on the Indian Affairs Commission. Mm-hmm. Was this the first time that you were on the Indian Affairs Commission? Or I don't recall that having come up before in our discussions.
When did we do that? I think we did that the session before. I don't know if I've got anything here that tells me that.
Well, I have a list of your committee assignments in 75, but I don't see anything regarding...
Well, that was not during the legislation. Well, we did meet during the legislature, but that was kind of ongoing.
Uh-huh.
We created a commission on Indian services. You don't have that anywhere, huh, when we did that? I'm trying to remember. I think it was 1975. We created the Legislative Commission on Indian Services, which I was a major sponsor. And the whole idea was, and I can recall that very well, because you began to learn about the Native Americans and some things that you didn't really know, should have known probably. But there was a lot of services that the state could provide to the Oregon Indians that they weren't taking advantage of, but they should have. There was a kind of a distrust. All of these things I'm telling you is kind of a learning process, and you learn about it. But the tribes in Oregon were accustomed to dealing with the federal government, and they were a nation. We use the word treaty, just like we use a treaty with France or a treaty with Great Britain or a treaty with Japan or whatever. It was a treaty. Mm-hmm. And so you look at it in terms, we had a treaty with a nation. So that's the way the Indians looked at it as well. And they didn't want to really get involved with state. They are a country. They're going to deal with the United States of America. Well, there were a lot of services really that meant mostly human resource services that they weren't taking advantage of, that the state could be involved, because they just weren't trusting the state. They didn't want to get involved with the state. And so the Commission on Indian Services really was basically designed to kind of create a bridge. And the concept of the Commission on Indian Services was that there would be, the tribes in Oregon would be represented. That would be not just reservation tribes, but urban tribes, because we had the Portland urban area, we had besides Warm Springs and Umatilla and Burns and Paiute. And there was the Metropolitan Indians in Eugene and the Coastal Indians in Southern Oregon. That's before most of the tribal statuses became recognized. Now many of the tribes are recognized. So anyway, they'd be represented. They would be one Senate member and one House member. Mm-hmm. And I was a Senate member. And one of the things I lamented, having been elected governor, is that obviously I'm not in the legislature anymore, and so I had to leave my post as a representative of the state senate and on the Commission on Indian Services. That's continued over all the years, and I really, really feel very good about my relations. And it continued as I was governor, mm-hmm. my relations with the Indians in Oregon.
Was this the conception or the original point for you to become involved with Indian Affairs then?
Well, it could have been. I was trying to find the year when we started.
Uh-huh.
There was a lot of reluctance, and we talked with the Indians, and I can recall talking with them in my office. And there was no coercion. We were going to create it. In tribes wanted to join the commission, they could do it. If they didn't want to, they didn't have to. That was part of the idea. And Umatilla signed up the last, quite standoffish about the whole thing. But they were welcome to come to the meetings and watch what we were doing, and they eventually said, I guess that's okay, and they signed up and became members of the commission. And of course, they can leave anytime they want. And it was very good. It was very good in providing services for Indians that they were not taking advantage of.
I don't know if you want to talk about it right now. I'm trying to remember the specific time, but the wasn't there sort of a gradual dissolution of the Klamath tribe, and eventually they were seeking compensation, or the government was going to compensate them for the dissolution of their tribal organization or official recognition of their tribal recognition.
Yeah, you want to push that off. When you talk about the Klamath and what, I'm not sure how much diversion you want to get and start talking about the American Indian and certainly the Indians in Oregon. Yes, they had actually, by their own vote, sold their property, and they got paid for it. It was kind of a disaster because they got the money, the tribal members got the money, they spent the money, and now they don't have any money. They didn't have any money before, and they don't have the land, and they don't have the money. A short version of the whole thing. They did finally, not too long ago, got restored their tribal status, and they've got a small amount of reservation now in Klamath. And the different reservations acted in different ways. Umatilla has been a large reservation for a long period of time. Oh, through their history, however, they sold property within the reservation. So if you were to look at a map that shows private ownership versus Indian ownership, it would look like you shot a shotgun through there. You know, just scattered all over the place. And it creates some kind of a problem because you've got non-Indians who own property living in the reservation. On the other hand, Warm Springs, they received money because of Salado Falls. They did not hand it all out. And they've got a tribal council that, and budgets and all. They've done a very good job. And also, although they didn't have too much sale within the reservation, they acquired what was little that was there. And I think now that the tribe owns, 97-98% of all the property on their reservation. Siletz was the first of those that got their tribal status restored. And followed then quite a few tribes in Oregon, and I acquiesced to all of them. Anyone that was they asked the governor, what do you think? Yeah, you bet. But Siletz, I can recall going down there to celebrate the restoration of their tribal status. They have a small amount of land for their reservation. They got a little bit more somehow to sustain them, if there was some way to sustain them. So they can kind of operate on their own. The Grand Ronde, they ran into some kind of problems. The non-Indians and Oregonians were maybe fighting them sometimes because they wanted fishing rights, they wanted hunting rights, they wanted land, and the non-Indians weren't, you know, not willing to give up a lot of that. By and large, though, in Oregon, it's gone through quite relatively non-controversial. But I enjoy my relationships with the Indians, still do today. I'm still, you know, like them, I visit them when I can. I'm on the board of museum at Warm Springs. I really like that relationship very much.
A lot of people consider the Warm Springs group to be one of the most successful in the country. Why is that, and why didn't other Indian groups emulate their example?
It's hard to tell the why. I can tell you they've had good leadership over the years. They established their own, which they could have done, and it was controversial, but they've got their own, let me call it, constitution. We celebrated the 50th anniversary of that, what was it, a couple of years ago, I think. They didn't just get the money and distribute it. They used it for the benefit of the whole tribe. Mm-hmm. They have senior housing. They have their own court system. And they do it quite judiciously, police force. They have an education program, but then they do pay money to Madras for their students, which go to the Madras schools. They have an early childhood center, which is fairly new. They've built Kaneda, mm-hmm. which lost money for a long period of time, mm-hmm. but they hung on. It's doing well now. Now the museum, they put in $3 million against about a $7.5 million operation, and we're approaching $6 million, I think. Need to collect some more money. But they've done what they think is benefiting the whole tribe rather than saying, just an individual. So why, it's hard to tell. I think they've had good leadership, or persuasive leadership. That's not to say that, Umatilla would be the next big one. Siletz has had good leadership, but they were just recently restored to tribal status. Burns Paiute out there in Eastern Oregon and Burns, Oregon, they've had some good leadership, but it kind of came and went. They didn't have much asset to deal with. Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell, but yes, you're right. They're very progressive tribe. Done very well.
You were also on the Property Tax Relief and Expenditure Limitation Committee group. Was that specifically for that session to deal with those issues? Or is that that's not a standing committee, is it?
No. I'm trying to think of timing there.
There were some tax issues that you did. You were dealing with at that time, and in fact, Senate President Jason Bowe's top priority bill would have allowed school districts to fall back on their previous year's tax levies.
Oh yeah. Okay,
plus
The
safety net.
There you go. That was the one described by Senator Carson, looking at the bill, talking about Jason Bowe's safety net. Is how do you fall up to a safety net?
Well, they wanted to be able to fall back on the previous year's tax levies plus increases of up to 6%.
Yeah, that was the established tax basis for all districts and all the rest of it. Yeah.
And that was soundly defeated in the special election.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lawmakers approved a measure in the waning hours to require school districts to seek voter approval of new property tax bases if they previously asked the people to approve tax levies of more than 6% above their old tax bases. And the legislature also appropriated $617 million to raise state aid to schools to 40% of total cost by the year 78-79 school year, the highest level of state support in many years. So is this what you were dealing with in this?
You said something, and it's. I'll give you a story.
Okay.
After Jason's safety net bill failed, I said to him, Jason, why don't we pass a law that says that if a school district tries for a new budget and they are unsuccessful, and I'm trying to remember one or two times, I don't recall that, by state law they have to go to an election for a new tax base.